I think sometimes success is just stick-to-itiveness. And, you know, part of it is based on attrition. I think people sometimes get into academics and they don't stay in it. And so I think just being in the game for a while, I think helps a lot.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Radiology Report podcast, where we are having conversations with the leaders transforming radiology today. You can find us on radiologyreportpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Daniel Arnold. Today, we are joined by Dr. Suresh Mukherjee. Dr. Mukherjee currently holds academic appointments at numerous institutions, such as the University of Louisville and University of Illinois, and serves as the National Director of Head and Neck Radiology at ProScan Imaging. He is a devoted educator and is the consulting editor for both Neuroimaging Clinics and Magnetic Resonance Clinics of North America and associate editor for the Journal of Computer-Assisted Tomography. If that wasn't enough, he is also the head and neck advisor for Medality, which is how we've gotten to know each other and become close friends and partners over the years. And full disclosure, he is an investor and advisor on Medality. He is a real key reason of our success and growth over the past years since we launched it in 2020. So, Suresh, welcome to the show.
Hey, Daniel. Thanks a lot for having me.
So, you have had one of the most flowering academic and educational careers out there, and your passion for teaching head and neck radiology is really unmatched. We love working with you. But tell us, how did you find your way into this world of radiology? Where'd you grow up, and what brought you to today?
Well, thanks, Daniel. I mean, it's mutual too. I mean, I love working with Medality. I love working with you. I love working with the team. It's just an amazing group of people. So I guess my story was that my parents came over from the old country. They came over from India. And then we moved to Nashville, Tennessee when I was about six. And I was born in England. So people always say it's like first generation or second generation or third generation. Well, I've been asked that so many times that I actually Googled it. And it turns out I'm 1.75 generations. So first generation is if you come over from India. Second generation, if you're born here. But if you were born in a different country from where your parents are from, then you add a percentage. If you come over when you're younger, you're closer to second. But if you come over when you're older, then you continue to subtract. So I actually did the calculations. I think I need an AI algorithm for that, but I think it was technically, it's a 1.75 generation. So I came over, we lived in Nashville about 4 or 5 years, and then we ended up moving to Louisville in 1973. So, you know, when I say my quote unquote home growing up really was Louisville, Kentucky, it's well known to the boards, people of my vintage, because that's where we had the oral boards.
Making a comeback. The oral boards.
Oh, no, it was kind of nutty because, you know, when I grew up in Louisville, boards were held at the Executive and West. And when I grew up, there were only like three really good hotels in Louisville, and one was the Executive and West. And I actually spent a couple of New Year's Eves there because it was a place to go. And then when I became a radiologist, everyone started criticizing, dishing, and making fun of this iconic hotel. So for me, it was like, come on now, people live there. We liked the Executive and West, but I think we were definitely the minority. So I graduated in 1979, then I'm going to Duke University and graduated there in 83, went to Georgetown for med school, did my residency. And the way I sort of got into radiology, like for most things, it's completely unexpected. My first exposure to radiology, I remember, I think it was either first or second year medical student. And I remember a professor showing a sagittal image of the brain. And I'm sitting back there, I'm like, wow, that is really cool. And for the first time, I said to myself, wow, we're going to be able to, you know, see normal anatomy using these incredible tools. And then we'll be able to eventually diagnose pathology. Those are sort of things that went through my mind back in the last century. Again, it was like 1984, I think. And then completely out of the blue, when I was at Georgetown, I played on the tennis team at Duke. And one of my old classmates was in DC, and he invited me to go to a party, a black tie party. And this was in the roaring 80s. So, you know, everyone was having a good time. And so I said, sure, I'll go to this party. And it was a black tie party held at a nice place in DC. And I didn't know anyone. So I'm just kind of sitting there. And I was really interested in research. I remember the table I was sitting at, I just happened to strike up a conversation with this one individual. And it turns out he was a head of nuclear medicine at Georgetown. His name is John Harbert. So John and I talked, and I told him I really wanted to do research and how I, you know, I didn't know really what I wanted to do, but I really wanted to do that. And so the next day he offered me a summer fellowship in nuclear medicine. And I got the fellowship. I spent the summer working with him, and John became really a lifelong mentor, lifelong friend. And we were in contact really over the next 30 to 40 years. So that's how I got into radiology. It's completely unexpected, but if I had to do it all again, I'd do the same thing.
Amazing. So you get excited about radiology, you're starting to see the light. What is your first job? What are the job prospects like at that time? And how did you think about it? And you know, where'd you end up? What'd you end up doing?
Yeah, so you know, for me, I ended up doing a residency at the Brigham, and I've wanted to do research and teaching since I was 17. I mean, my first job, if you will, in college during the summer between my first and second year was volunteering in a research lab. So I remember learning how to pipette and, you know, do basic analysis back then. And so for me, I've always wanted to do teaching and research. That's just kind of who I am. So for me, the job prospects were always, I was just looking for academic positions. And at that time, there were, you know, quite a few coming out of my fellowship program. So at that time, you know, I wasn't really focused on the market. I do remember the market swings at the time for some of my junior staff were thinking about going out into private practice at the time. So I did hear bits and pieces like, you know, residents do. But for me, it was just try to find the best institution that would allow me to pursue my dreams and interests.
And where was that that you ended up?
So I did my residency at the Brigham, and that was from 88 to 92. And then I did a two-year neuro fellowship. And the second year was really focused on head and neck, but I was doing everything. I did brain, I did angios, I did sort of neurointerventional light during those days. If you had embolization of head and neck tumors and other disorders, I would do that. And then obviously I did head and neck. So my first faculty position was at University of North Carolina, and I started there in July of 1994.
So what drew you to the head and neck?
You know, it's another great question. So my first day of my residency, I was actually on the neuroradiology rotation. And so for the first day, you sort of, you know, you dive into the ocean, you're drinking from a fire hose, you can say whatever metaphor you want. But the first day I was completely overwhelmed. The second day I'm sitting at these days we had alternators, Daniel. I don't know if you know what an alternator is or if you don't know what film is, but
I know what an alternator is, but maybe our audience doesn't know what an alternator is. That's the way I can hide behind that one.
Yeah. So we were sitting at the alternator with films with a grease pencil. And actually I remember at that time when we were really looking at anatomy, we would actually take a paperclip and we'd unfold it and we'd take the tip of the paperclip and we would like, you know, go over anatomy. And the second day of my residency, which was on the neuroradiology rotation, I had a really great fellow. Jane Weissman was my fellow. And there's this great attending named Bob Schick. And I think they're both around. They're fabulous neuroradiologists. But I remember them going over the foramina of the skull base on CT. And all of a sudden, I had this strange epiphany because, you know, when you're going through medical school and you're going through any education, you're learning all this minutiae. You're like, where am I ever going to use this stuff again? I mean, why in the world am I learning about, you know, the pterygopalatine fossa? Why am I learning about these various skull-based foramina? Well, they went through and took that little paper clip and pointed at all these foramina on film at an alternator. And they said, well, there's foramen ovale. I'm like, oh, I remember I learned that. Oh, there's foramen spinosum. Oh, I remember I learned that. There's foramen rotundum. This is great. There's foramen magnum. There's the optic canal. And all of a sudden, I'm like, this is really cool in the sense that it's something that I'd learned that I was really had a challenge learning it. But now I can see it and I can see it, how it actually makes a difference in all these nerves we learned about. And so from at that time, you know, the light bulb went on. And it's my second day of my residency. I'm like, I want to do this. And I remember, you know, at that time telling a couple people and they said, you're crazy. I said, why? Because no one does that. And I said, why doesn't anyone do it? Well, first of all, it's hard and it's too complicated and just no one ever does it. And so when I heard those things being told to me, just because I like a challenge, I'm like, I'm going to be a head and neck radiologist. And that was from starting from day three of my residency, I knew that's what I wanted to do.
What makes it hard? Why did folks say, you know, this is a hard field to get into?
Well, I think head and neck is a very challenging area because it's a relatively small area compared to, let's say, the leg. But the amount of anatomy and the complexity of the anatomy is something that's a little bit more intricate.
Quick defining question for the audience. What's the difference between head and neck imaging and brain imaging? Where does the brain stop and the head and neck start?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, the brain is sort of obviously the top of your body. When we say head, neck, and it's a great question, the brain basically sits on a bony platform, and that bony platform is called the skull base. So if you look at your brain, it sits on this bony shelf, and from that bony shelf all the way down to your clavicles is what we quote unquote refer to as the head and neck. So for me, that head and neck area is like a relay station because you have to take all of the anatomy and all of the sensory and motor functions of the brain, and somehow it has to be transmitted to the rest of your body. And, you know, when we talk about the five senses, you know, all those five senses are essentially in your head and neck area. You know, things that really make us human, you know, the ability to laugh, to smile, to cry, those are all emotions that are in our head and neck area. So that area of complexity and the relay station and all the various nerves that allow us to be human are all located in that head and neck area. And that's where part of that intricacy comes from.
Got it. Thanks for that helpful, if not scary, visual. So it sounds like part of it is the anatomy. You're packing quite a bit. I mean, you think about your leg, how big your leg is, you know, versus your face and the number of things your face does versus your leg. So there's a lot more anatomy and going on in a smaller space. And so that's part of the challenge. Is that right? Are there other parts that make it hard?
Yeah, that's 100% right. It's that normal anatomy that's there. So basically you take the anatomy of your whole leg and you compress it into about 7 inches and all of that is there. And then plus you have the concentration of, you know, different types of nerves. And then you have the pathology that occurs there. So, you know, it's hard enough knowing the normal anatomy because I think in general in med school, you just don't spend a lot of time in the head and neck. I always say when I was in the gross anatomy lab, we spent like, I think, 6 weeks on the liver and 6 weeks on the leg. And then when we looked at all of the areas in what I refer to as the head and neck, you know, we covered that in 3 weeks. And that includes the ability to smile, to laugh, to cry, to eat, you know, all the sensations. We covered that in, you know, 3 weeks. And that's a lot of anatomy. And so you're never really given a really good foundation of it.
So the anatomy is complex and the pathology is complex also because you've got so many different things that can go wrong, things that can happen. So how is the pathology and maybe our ability to detect the pathology changed during your career? Because you mentioned you started out and it was film and you're kind of excited about what's happening. But at that time, was what you could figure out more limited, or was it all there and it was just, you know, lower definition? And how is the ability to detect the pathology changed? Is it still changing?
That's a great question. And there are a lot of layers to that. So first of all, as I kind of reflect back on my 30 years of doing this, I always kind of joke, like I was the smartest radiologist when I finished my fellowship because I kind of thought I knew everything. And so every generation thinks like they're the smartest. But as you get older, you have more wear and tear and you become, you know, a little bit more circumspect about your life and what you do. And what I realized after about 10 years into it was that the pathology has been the same over many years. So for instance, if I'm looking at a temporal bone CT and I detect some of this pathology that we see on temporal bone CT. So I'll give you a couple examples. You know, sometimes you have anomalous bone in your ear that makes you deaf. It's called otosclerosis. And it's pretty subtle. It's only about, you know, 2 or 3, sometimes 4 or 5 millimeters. That disorder we can detect on temporal bone CT, which was something that evolved during my training and also as I kind of matured in my career. But the thing is that before us, that pathology was already there. And it was some of these incredible head and neck radiologists like Mahmoud Mafi and Dino Valvasori, they were able to detect it on technology that doesn't even compare to what we have right now. So they used to do things like conventional tomography, which is basically taking plain films and doing a sort of an antiquated technique, but they were able to detect these things. So in an odd way, you know, we haven't changed the pathology, but it's actually easier for us to see it. And so the first thing when I'm kind of asked this question is I have to pay homage and credence to the people that were before me, because the pathology has been the same. It was just harder to detect. And I wouldn't have the knowledge I have now if it really wasn't for those individuals that preceded me. So over time, the pathology is, in a way, has been the same, but we've figured out how to detect it a little bit more easier, more convincingly, and also pick it up at an earlier stage.
What lectures do you enjoy giving the most? If you, you know, to give one more talk and that's it, like which one are you giving?
I probably give a talk on the larynx.
The larynx. Okay, why?
Well, I think in a way it kind of encapsulates nicely what you kind of alluded to. I think for me with head and neck radiology is, number one, you have this incredibly difficult anatomy, and then you have the pathology on top of that. But then you sort of ask how things have changed over time regarding head and neck, is that when we started things out and we started looking at CT and MR of the head and neck and even in PET imaging, you know, we realized in our subspecialty, wow, technology is really changing, techniques are changing, and we can see this. But the hardest thing was to convince our referring physicians. So one of the really cool things about head and neck, and this happened just when I was starting my fellowship, is that there were times where people say, we could never see lymph nodes on CT. It just wasn't possible. And all of a sudden, we're starting to see lymph nodes on CT. So we as a radiologist could see it, but to actually convince our clinicians, our referring physicians, that they could see it, it takes another 10-year lag. So the thing why I would give the larynx talk is, number one, you know, you get to talk about this complex anatomy, which is really difficult. And part of the joy I give is trying to explain it such that the light bulb goes on and people actually understand it. The second thing is to talk about different pathologies. But the next thing is really to talk about how tumors spread and how what we say as radiologists makes a difference in how these patients are treated. And then finally, you know, I've been doing this long enough where I've been on the staging committee, the AJCC staging committee, American Joint Commission on Cancer staging, since 20 years now. And now imaging has actually been integrated implicitly in staging. So what we say on radiology is inherently in now embedded in the staging system. So we've actually gone all the way to the end of the spectrum regarding what we say now directly affects how these patients are treated. And I would even take it one step further, because when I would make this argument 10 years ago, people would say, well, that's great. You guys do a fabulous job as a radiologist, but eventually the pathologist has to confirm what you say. So if we say there's invasion of a certain structure like a cartilage, well, the pathologist has to confirm that. But what's happened over the last 10 years or so is that some of these cancers of the head and neck that we thought would only be treated by surgery, so we'd always have surgical confirmation on what we said, are now being treated non-surgically. And a lot of that decision is based on, we say, pre-treatment on our preoperative or pre-treatment imaging. So we may not even get surgical confirmation, but the information that we provide is so robust and it's pivotal to how these patients are treated. So we may never have surgical confirmation. So in a way, we've almost become, and I say this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, de novo pathologist pre-treatment, because now we can actually direct how these patients are treated. So that's why I would give the larynx talk, because it sort of encapsulates this whole journey over the last, you know, 25 or 30 years.
You know, the piece of that I latch on to is the part of radiology that excites me, the reason modality exists, is to disseminate information in a way that impacts patients. And so how quickly can you take standards of care that are being developed in the, you know, best academic institutions in the world and make that accessible globally and raise care worldwide? But something you said in there that was really interesting, I don't know that I've ever thought about before, which is it's not just enough for the radiologist to know it, but also the referring physicians need to know it, and the stakeholders within the healthcare system need to know it too. And so taking it from not just, you know, this is an interesting academic finding, to Yep. You need to figure out how to teach your partners, you know, you're the consultant, and how are you going to educate them on, you know, driving the patient outcome forward? So that's a really important element of the teaching process. You know, you've been at this for some time. It wouldn't be a Radiology Report podcast if I didn't bring up my wife. I always talk about Taylor, my conduit into radiology. And so she went to the ASNR conference this year. And she said she couldn't take two steps with you without someone recognizing you and coming up to say hello and how big of a fan of yours they were. So I'm blowing smoke a little bit, but I do want to know, like, how does one build a large network, a global reputation? The part of the audience of this podcast are sort of young, up and coming radiologists. Maybe they want to pursue a career in academics and pursue a career as an educator. You know, obviously we work with hundreds of them. So, you know, how should they look up to what you've done and what can they, you know, apply?
Well, Daniel, thanks for the kind words. I mean, Taylor's fabulous. And so, you know, I think you sort of both married above your heads, but you guys are so amazing that you didn't really marry above your head. So, I mean, great respect for you. And Taylor's one of the brightest young radiologists of her generation I've seen. I mean, she's really, really fabulous. And both of you just great people. So, you know, thanks for those kind words.
We'll edit that out, but appreciate it.
No, I mean that sincerely. I think part of it is, you know, you have to be around. I think sometimes success is just stick-to-itiveness. And, you know, part of it is based on attrition. I think people sometimes get into academics and they don't stay in it. And so I think just being in the game for a while, I think helps a lot. I think secondly, you know, there are various layers to this. You know, when I grew up, there was no social media. And nothing against social media, but when I was first starting out, the way we got our name out there was through publishing. You know, it's through publishing lots of papers, lots of books and things like that. So as you know, I've got, I think, 14 or 15 books right now, a few journal articles and things like that. So I think that sort of laid the foundation. At that time, that's how you sort of got known. But, you know, there are thousands of incredible educators and teachers just in radiology. And if you look at, you know, all medical specialties, there are hundreds of thousands of people. I guess the one thing that I like to keep in mind, especially as you get older, is that you can't take yourself too seriously. And everyone that's a radiologist has a lot to offer. I, as a sub-specialist, can sort of do what I do, but sometimes you take yourself at times too seriously. You sort of get into your little lockbox and you think you're sort of a pseudo expertise, but it's important to realize that there are a lot of people that can do what you do. There are a lot of people that really do a good job at what you do and can do even do more things that you can. So I think my sense is kind of, you know, looking at individuals, always trying to be respectful of them, not take yourself too seriously, but also you try to be authentic and learn from others too. And I think that's one of the lessons I wish I would have probably learned early in my career, is that you can learn things from everyone. So I think over time, if you have a certain level of sincerity and authenticity, appreciate the relationships and appreciate just interacting with really, really great individuals that have chosen the same field that you do. I guess maybe that's why I have gotten to know, you know, quite a few people over my time.
On the stick-to-itiveness, you know, first of all, there's a startup visit, which is like, just don't die. And if you don't die, you'll make it. And that generally works out pretty well. And knock on wood, you know, we haven't died yet. I think there's something to that. But the stick-to-itiveness also requires some pretty intense sacrifice. You know, give us a sense, like, how many talks did you give last year? How often were you on the road?
Yeah, last year was kind of unusual, but, you know, thanks for bringing that up. I mean, if I did the individual number of talks, probably 100 last year, you know, because I do a lot of stuff online with distance learning and so on and so forth.
You know, I don't think it's unfair to share, because I think, what does it mean to stick with it, right? So, well, sticking with it means you're an established person, you're still giving 100 talks this year. Don Resnick, another friend of the pod, friend of the company, you know, he's in his, I think, 70s now, and he still is, you know, lecturing weekly and goes to 10, 12 countries a year. So there's a little bit of that drive that has to undergird all of this, which is hopefully comes from a passion. If it doesn't come from a passion, it won't work. But like, hey, I love this stuff, and we heard how much you love it. And then two, you know, I'm going to stick with it. And then three, like, you actually got to put in the work and put in the hours. And certainly you've done that. But it's cool how the internet has kind of supercharged that for a lot of folks. And your ability to not have to get on a plane to give every talk then enhances that reach even further. Switching gears a little bit, so beyond just education, you're getting more involved, call it, in the industry broadly, thinking about trends, thinking about, you know, where does radiology go from here, you know, thinking about your role in all of that. One way that you've been sort of gaining impact in this space is through the LeapFrog Fellowship, which, funny enough, I'd not heard of before we talked. And then I just sat in a presentation where someone shared statistics from the LeapFrog Foundation related to quality. So as I understand, the LeapFrog, you know, Foundation is very focused on patient safety, driving quality outcomes in the US and around the world. So kind of like, what is it? How did you get involved in it? And what drew you to this opportunity?
Yeah, so I've always been involved. The other half of me really sort of involved in the public policy work. So when I got my MBA, when I was mid-career, I think I was 49 when I got my MBA. Back at Duke, I was actually, at that time, I was a double major. I was zoology, because there was no neuroscience major at the time. But I was also an economics major. So at some point, I kind of saw those merging. And I remember back again in, you know, 1982, 1981, people said, you know, why would you ever want to do economics and zoology? It makes no sense. And if you're going to med school, just be zoology. And then for me, I always felt, even at that time, you know, 40 years ago, medicine was a business. And I don't think people really understood it at the time. So I've always had this interest, and it was just a matter of time where I wanted those things to meld. And that sort of happened when I was division director at University of Michigan. So, you know, we sort of grew the division. It's a fabulous division, fabulous institution. But I also really got involved in a lot of the financial aspects of the department. And then, as luck would have it, I got involved in public policy at the state. So I was on the Certificate of Need Commission for, I think, 7 years. And the Certificate of Need basically is a state regulation. In Michigan, the healthcare is regulated by the state. I was actually chair of that commission. So through that role, I got it because it wasn't just radiology. It was basically all 23 services of healthcare were covered through this commission that I was on and was chair of. And a lot of this is driven by the people that actually purchase our services. So what's interesting to me is that we as physicians, and especially the patients, really are the center of the healthcare system. But on the other hand, as physicians, we provide services. It's basically goods and services, and the service that we provide is healthcare. So we, as physicians, think that we are the center of healthcare because we're the ones that provide the care. We go to medical school to learn how to do this, and we take the risks and we get some of the rewards. But the people that actually purchase our services are the companies and the corporations that buy healthcare for their employees. We get paid by payers, insurance companies. The largest company is Medicare, Medicaid, CMS. So those are two other pieces. So I have patients and I have providers, and we have purchasers and payers. And in the healthcare space, nothing really happens unless you have policies and procedures and laws that allow this. And that gets into the final fifth and sixth P, which are policy and the politics. So those things have always kind of interested me. So those are, if you will, the six P's of healthcare. And if you really want to gild the lily, there's a seventh P, which is pharmacy and pharma. Especially coming off of COVID, everyone knows how important the drug companies were. So that has always interested me. And when I was at University of Michigan, I got exposed to the LeapFrog group, because at that time in mid-2000s, we were a big advocate of quality and safety, and LeapFrog group was the main watchdog of this. So over the last 7 or 8 years, as I've become more interested in the perspective of healthcare purchasers and payers, the LeapFrog group is a way to identify high quality hospitals. And the way they've done that is predominantly through their health and safety grades. So that's where the link is, because purchasers, when they're purchasing healthcare services, want to try to purchase the best quality. Well, what's a way we can find quality? Well, we always default to safety. And that's how I got sort of involved in the LeapFrog group. And that's how it sort of ties together with people that purchase healthcare services.
And what did you do, you know, at the LeapFrog Foundation? What did you participate in?
Yeah, it was a fabulous fellowship. I'm just coming off the end of it. You know, we were, first of all, we got to meet Leah Binder, who's the CEO of the LeapFrog group, and she's a force of nature. All she wants to do is provide the best and safest hospital systems. And the LeapFrog group dates back to about 25 or 30 years, and Leah has that same passion. So she really is a force of nature. So during that year, we spent a lot of time with Jill Berger, who sort of ran the fellowship. We had a series of lectures over that year. We went on a, if you will, a field trip, and we were able to see the Leapfrog headquarters. We also spent a half day on Capitol Hill advocating for the Leapfrog mission, which is hospital and safety. We also, later on in the fall, you know, from our standpoint, we all think our hospitals are the best, but when you actually look at different perspectives, you know, some hospitals are, I don't want to say they're not as good, but let's just say they have different priorities and different resources. So we were able to spend time at, you know, tertiary and quaternary care institutions, but we also spent time at safety net hospitals in places that I would never have gone to organically, but they're the ones that really have the toughest patient populations. And we were able to see an amazing story of one hospital in the south side of Chicago that went from an F all the way to an A. So we were able to learn their story, learn how they did it, how they prioritized it. This is a hospital that was hoping they would actually get Medicare patients because that would help their bottom line. Most people want to have private patients. They don't think they can make a living off Medicare, but that tells you the type of situation those hospitals are in. So that's kind of the exposure that we got. It's not really seen by, you know, the average physician. And then I also did a year-long project that was really focused on diagnostic testing, diagnostic errors, and how purchasers and payers make decisions when they decide to reimburse new diagnostic tests.
So on the diagnostic side, you know, what did you learn about the diagnostic side of the equation? How do errors play a role? How big of a problem is it? Can you put it in perspective?
Well, the whole thing about diagnostic errors in healthcare really started to Errors Human, which was a study that was published by the National Academy in 2000. And that really started this tidal wave of focusing on health and safety for our patients. And then in 2015, there was a Blue Ribbon Committee that was sponsored by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, Medicine, that was called Improving Diagnosis in Healthcare. And that study was incredibly important because what it identified at the time was that over 5% of US adults are going to experience some type of diagnostic error on the outpatient. Nearly all of us are going to have some type of diagnostic error. And I'm not talking about a radiology error, but this is an error in diagnosis. And I know I've seen that because my father died of pancreatic cancer. And the first MRI that he had was read as negative, and it turns back there were multiple liver metastases at the time, and this was back in 1990. So when I heard that each one of us is going to be affected, you know, I'm living proof of that. So every one of us is going to be affected by a diagnostic error, and they contribute to about 40 to 80,000 deaths per year. These are avoidable deaths. So this has been the real focus on diagnostic errors. And it is one of the leading types of paid medical malpractice claims as well, too.
How do groups go about reducing diagnostic errors?
So when you mean groups, you mean radiology groups or enterprise hospital systems? Or...
Whichever perspective you have on it, whether it be from the radiology side or from the broader healthcare system side, you know, what are some of the thinkings that were coming out of the sessions that you were participating in?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. So I'll answer it in two parts. So let's say if we look at a regular radiology group that either has multiple contracts or working in a larger healthcare system. First of all, you have to have the conversation. You know, the leaders have to mention diagnostic errors and diagnostic quality. So you have to have that conversation within your group, because if it's not even part of your normal dialogue, then you're going to be focused on other things. You're going to be focused on throughput. You're going to be focused on protocols, you're going to be focused on, you know, fill in the blank, there are numerous ones. So first of all, whoever the leader is has to say, hey, this is a priority for our group. So the second thing is, if you want to get a little bit more tangible, is how within a radiology group, not only do you talk about it, but how do you make tangible improvements that can reduce your diagnostic errors? You can begin to incentivize people for that. Many groups are just incentivized purely on how much they read, how many RVUs they do, how fast they can read it, so on and so forth, the eat what you kill mentality. And you can really get focused on that. So it's not necessarily, you know, the person that reads 200 studies is viewed as a better radiologist than someone that may need less, but maybe making less errors. So, you know, you have to incentivize individuals to a certain level. And obviously, all radiology groups should be doing some type of peer review. Now, if you look at the enterprise level, which is what a lot of these CMS STARS data does and what the Leapfrog data does too, is that you have to develop multidisciplinary teams at the institutional level that are going to look at diagnostic errors and figure out exactly which service lines within that hospital they would like to focus on, or where they can get the easiest data, or where they think those various pitfalls are. So one really is at the institutional level, and one is really more at the group level.
What are some of the common diagnostic errors you see in head and neck?
That's a great question. You know, I think head and neck, first of all, I'm fortunate because I'm a neuroradiologist. I spend most of my time doing head and neck. And so what I've noticed is that the overall quality of head and neck has actually improved over the last 30 years. So back in the 80s and 90s, I would say there may have been a few more quote unquote misses or oversights. But, you know, our national organizations, I think, did a great job in around the late 1990s to include at that time head and neck into the curriculum for neuroradiology. So there's brain, spine, and head and neck was one of the three pillars. So I think over the last 20 years, the quality has gotten much, much better. I think occasionally people may miss an occasional tumor. Sometimes they can be pretty subtle. Sometimes you'll see things like spread along nerves not identified. So, you know, there are different ways to look at errors. I think part of it is you can look at an error and you can say, number one, did they get the right study? So inappropriate use or getting the wrong study is one type of error. In general, that's kind of low. The next thing is that if you just miss something, and in general, I think that's kind of unusual, but, you know, someone may miss a specific tumor or a specific lymph node. The next thing is, well, if you see it, did you give the right diagnosis? Or did you place it in the right body part? Sometimes I'll see lesions that are actually in the wrong body part, and it was just incorrectly assigned. And then if you don't have the right body part and you give a differential diagnosis, well, then your differential diagnosis is wrong. So I think when you look at diagnostic errors, you have to look at it almost as a value stream or a process and realize there are different areas on that spectrum when we talk about errors in head and neck and any part of radiology.
We're almost out of time, but wanted to talk a little bit about some of the big trends that you're seeing. We talked about the seven Ps. Purchasers and payers are going to really influence radiology because, as you said, you know, at the end of the day, we provide a service and they buy it from us. And so they hold a lot of influence over, you know, how we operate on a daily basis. And so what do you see as being the big trends that are going to impact us over the next generation of radiologists?
Yeah. If we look at megatrends as a whole, I'll say this, you know, I've been doing this now for 30 years and Daniel, six times they've predicted the death of radiology. Okay. In the 1980s, when I wanted to become a radiologist, they said there's not enough technology. Then in the 1990s, it was the RAPs. It was radiology, anesthesia, pathology, where they wanted to throttle hospital-based physicians and pay them a certain amount of money. That said, no one's going to go into radiology. That got killed. You know, that went away, if you will. Then in the late 1990s, they said everything's going to be interpreted by different specialists. And then in 2000, there was offshore interpretation. ACR really put an end to that. In early 2010s, that's when we got hit by declining reimbursements. And so people said, well, our rates are going to go down. Who's going to go into radiology? And then the late 2010 was artificial intelligence, where we were going to be replaced. The biggest mega trend that I want to leave the listeners with is that the only constant over those last 30 years is that our field has continued to grow. And at times what we've done is some of our leaders, I think, have shot themselves in the foot because, you know, they react to these things. But in actuality, our growth continues to grow. So I always say that, you know, every graduating medical school class is good for radiology because they don't have time to really be trained on physical examination as we used to. You know, they're so reliant on imaging. In fact, you know, at some places, radiology is in charge of anatomy. So one mega trend is we're just going to continue to grow as a field. I don't really see a way. From a purchaser and payer standpoint, I think we do have to worry about trends such as reference-based pricing. We are going to have to worry about a little bit more price transparency. We are going to have to worry a little bit more about surprise billing. And then we always have to be a little bit concerned about more corporatization and more private equity, because I've had experience both in corporate radiology and also private equity owned radiology as well, too.
Suresh, this was awesome. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. I think that your time here has inspired countless aspiring academic radiologists and folks interested in driving change in the field, and your passion is like still as strong as it was, it sounds like, from the first day of residency, which is really cool to see. So I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. I really appreciate your time today, and also really appreciate your continued contributions to the Modality Platform. The global radiology community benefits from it immensely. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Daniel. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Radiology Report podcast. Be sure to visit us at theradiologyreportpodcast.com or subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts to join us for our next episode. We are always looking for great guests. If you have someone you'd like to hear on the show, please get in touch with us online.